bring the, we won't quite get started formally. We don't have a quorum, but welcome, Commissioner and Mr. Mueller, if you could identify yourself for the record, and we'll pick up, I believe we're on page 18. But go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Lyle Mueller. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And continuing where we left off, as you noted on page 18, taking a look at our full agency budget for FY 16 and 17, $392.2 million. Just breaking that down into our five budget components, the water, air, land. We have an acronym up there, EACM, which stands for Environmental Assistance and Cross Media. That's the fourth one. And then our admin support budget piece. So first we're going to take a look at the AIR program.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Adelk, and I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And we have an order going through these slides. What we'll do is we'll do a quick introduction in each area, then talk about the financing for each of the program areas, and then move into the governor's change items. And so on this one here, you see a picture of one of our folks working on an air monitoring program, and this location is in North Minneapolis, and the monitor for fine particulate and air toxins near two schools. And each one of these slides, you'll notice the last bullets talk about compliance. A lot of times when we end up having conversations about compliance or...
Excuse me, members, I'd like to bring the Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. And Representative Johnson, could you move the, or are you willing to move the minutes of February 11th?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I so move.
Discussion to the minutes of February 11th? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Amendments are adopted. Continue. I think it was you, Commissioner. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the last bullet is just a note of the rate of compliance in each of these areas, air, land, and water. A lot of times when we talk about compliance and enforcement, we always focus on those that don't aren't meeting the requirements or aren't following up with their duties. But that's not the whole story on compliance. There are, as you can see in these numbers, a vast majority of the permit holders are doing what is required of them and never get talked about. And we just want to make sure folks understand that there is high compliance in the state, and that's what this last bullet is. And as you can see in AIR, that's a 96% compliance rate.
So, Commissioner, if I can ask, you said this in North Minneapolis. Is it targeting an industrial area, or is it targeting vehicle traffic?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm just going to double check, but I believe this is one of our ambient air monitoring programs, so it's taking everything that's coming in the system. These are located next to two schools, and if you'd like more information, we can bring someone up and provide that.
Commissioner Kudelka, my question would be, is it the thought being that the schools are located close to roadway or close to industry? Good morning. Welcome. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Shannon Lotthammer. I'm the director of the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division, and that's the division that does our ambient air monitoring for Minnesota. And to this particular question, this is one, as Mr. Kudelka had noted, this is one of our ambient air monitoring sites, which are sited throughout Minnesota, including throughout the metro area, to characterize the overall air quality of our state, both in urban areas and then in greater Minnesota as well. So the site wasn't necessarily picked because it was close to a particular source, but more as representative of the area as a whole.
Thank you. There was additional questions. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kudelka, I have a question about the monitoring of air quality as it relates to the silica sand facilities in my district. Number of my constituents have expressed a concern that once it's established, the permit is granted, and if there were problems with the quality of the air, there's confusion or we lack understanding of what would happen at that point.
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I just want to clarify on that. There's two prongs on that. Are you talking more about if there's noncompliance and then compliance enforcement, or there's been some discussion of how long air monitoring needs to be done with our proposed rules?
Representative Johnson.
Actually, both, but my main concern is that if over, let's say, several years down the road, and it was shown that the compliant that there were some issues with the quality of the air related to the to that facility, what happens at that point?
Commissioner Kadalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, just a little background information. The legislature a couple of years ago required the MPCA to work on air quality rules for silica sand facilities. And one of the things we've been meeting with the advisory group, which includes citizens and industry representatives, is discussing what air monitoring may need to be done at the facility. And there's been a question, as Representative mentioned, about how long that air monitoring needs to be done depending on the test result. Silica sand or any other facility where we have data showing that there is a noncompliance in the area, we start investigating the issue as soon as we get the information. And that includes communications with parties in the area. If it's an ambient monitor like the one you see on the picture, there's a number of potential folks that may be contributing to that, so we get information. In your case, where you're talking about a specific monitor for a specific facility, we will talk to the facility, try to figure out what was happening at that time, that they maybe have a problem with the equipment that led to that, or if it's a larger issue that's ongoing, that steps need to be made to bring it back into compliance. So that's the process that we start to dialogue with them, investigate, get as much information as we can, and then determine a plan forward depending on if it was a one-time issue or a long-time concern.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then if there was an ongoing issue with it, what would be the steps that would be taken?
Commissioner Kadalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for any enforcement matter there, we would put together a plan to bring them back into compliance. Depending on what needs to be done, if it's something that's a quick remedy that could be done in days versus something that may take investment or time, that will be worked out with the in terms of what the environmental risk is and how long it would take to put in such a system. It really depends. Each of our enforcement cases are taken on a case-by-case basis because each situation is a little different, and we don't want to necessarily pigeonhole someone into one specific area.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Commissioner, to that point, you have to be careful as you move forward, because sometimes you'll have multiple air monitors around a facility, and maybe some are at all four corners of, say, a gravel facility, and maybe one or two of them are by the gravel road in front, and those happen to be the ones showing the bigger problem, and we come to find out it's actually the gravel road, not the facility. So we appreciate you being prudent about that and moving forward in a prudent manner. Representative Uglem.
We're here, Denny.
Okay, good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Kadalka, I understand that the federal clean air standards are going to be changing here in the near term. Is that correct?
Commissioner Kadalka, you got an hour?
Mr. Chair and committee members, you're correct. The ozone standard is something the federal government's looking at. They're looking at a range at this time. They are taking public comment on that, and once that change is made, we'll be able to tell where we are within that overall number. It was a slide. I don't know if folks kept the presentation from our earlier.
Right.
That showed the range. We can get you a copy if you'd like of that to show what the range that the federal government's looking at, and then also where our monitoring is at this point.
Representative Uglem, follow up.
Yeah, to that point, we have 96% of the air permit holders are complying now. I'm assuming once these new federal standards come online, we're going to see a significant decrease in that 96% figure. And I'm really concerned that the public is going to think, oh my gosh, we have this terrible air quality. How are we going to handle that potential PR disaster, really?
Well, Representative Uglem, you didn't see it. If you'd been on this side, you'd have saw it. But the folks behind you were all nodding no when you said, we think we're going to see a problem. So, Commissioner Kadalka. Yeah.
Mr. Chair and committee members, compliance is dealing with the individual's permit and the requirements in the permit. So when the overall standard may change, whether it's a state or water standard, we then have to go back into the permit and make that change for the individual facility. So when the feds change the air standard, ozone specifically, that will not mean everyone else then goes in the non-compliance. It just creates a list of work that we have to do to bring the overall state in there. And we would look at permitted facilities, such as those with the traditional smokestacks, but also non-regulated areas to see where we can help with voluntary efforts. Vehicles we drive are one of the largest sources in the metropolitan area and are things we'll need to target. Can we get paint shops to use water-based paint versus those with volatile organic compounds in it? And those are all areas that we can move instead of necessarily going at a facility permit.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kadelka, talking about air, has PCA or are they considering changing the emission standards from outdoor wood-burning stoves that obviously burn wood?
Mr. Kadelka, is that something, do we have future slides with that issue or no?
Mr. Chair, we do not. But
okay,
I
go ahead,
real quick.
Commissioner Kadelka.
A federal requirements right now for some wood stoves to have emission requirements on the manufacturer when they build them. The federal government has just put out its final rule that would make some changes to those and expand it to instance for outdoor wood boilers. Those are requirements that are put on the manufacturer when they build them. They are not specific requirements on a person in their home. How folks in their homes would, when they buy the next one, it would be in compliance. And over time, each of these stoves or wood boilers would be more efficient to help save costs, but also reduce emissions, and that would be worked in. Some states have looked at voluntary efforts to be able to help people make switch outs or put in inserts to help reduce emissions, but it's not anything on an individual.
Representative Fabian, follow up.
Yes, please. You said it would help save costs. Can you quantify that for me?
Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, one of the ways to reduce emissions is a more efficient burning system. And in that result, a more efficient system, it lowers the cost because there's less wood that needs to be used as an input.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how much is the the new standards is going to add how much to the purchase price of the outdoor wood boiler?
Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we can work with our staff to find out what the federal requirements are and look for those estimates.
If you could get us that information, that would be good. Follow-up, Representative Fabian.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would beg to differ with the agency if they think they're going to save costs for consumers overall on this. The costs incurred to manufacturers being passed on to the consumers, the people that would like to buy these, is going to greatly, in my opinion, exceed the cost of a few cords of wood that they actually burn. Most of the people that I'm associated with cut their own wood, and it's the price of a chainsaw and some gas and so forth. So I'm looking forward to further discussion on this as we move forward.
To this point, Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kadelka, and maybe this is something that we'll discuss at a later time, but I'm fairly confident that most of the folks that are talking about the wood boiler have not ever used one. And the reason I would say that is specifically addressing the cost point that you had just made, and I'd like to get your response on it. Most people don't understand that the new systems that you're describing that are going to be somewhat more efficient, that they are going to operate at a lower cost, and that's just not the case. And the reason for that is because the wood that those systems require is significantly different, and I mean, first of all, the size of the material is significantly smaller, so there's a lot more effort that goes into reducing the size and getting it to the proper moisture content. In existing systems, like I personally operate, you can burn a lot of things that you absolutely could not burn in the new stove systems that you're referring to. And I have operated both, and I can see that there's going to be a huge issue going forward. And if I could just get your response.
Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I will need to get back to you on that, on the cost estimates with our staff. I don't have that at my disposal right now.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And sort of piggybacking a little on Representative Uglin's comments about ozone and you know, how that's monitored and enforced. It reminded me of the discussion we had during the overview around non-attainment. And I guess, you know, to follow up from that, are these ozone monitors also, you know, going to give us information about how close the region is to, you know, running into trouble with non-attainment? And if so, you know, what's the strategy beyond public education? You know, I've heard a couple of times, you know, since the majority of these, you know, sources for ozone are, you know, automobiles, and we can't regulate individual automobiles, we're going to just do public education. I would also add that, you know, transit is and telecommuting and other ways are good strategies as well. But what can we do beyond public education? It feels like that's, you know, a little bit nebulous, and that would be question number one. And question number two is, you know, how close are we to non-attainment, and is the penalty still something like $300 million to the region if the federal government finds us in non-attainment?
Commissioner Cadell.
Mr. Chair and committee members, in terms of what can be done, the agency, along with a wide range of interested parties being led by Environmental Initiative that includes the Chamber of Commerce, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, have put together a number of proposals on ways to improve air quality. And a number of them are more than education, and I'll use two examples. One is the very successful program, Project Green Fleet, that's run by Environmental Initiative, which helps take the larger vehicles, diesel vehicles, and retrofit them to improve the air quality. We have done a lot of work in that area in terms of buses, and now the next moving is the heavy construction equipment. How do we get those systems, the older ones, the less efficient in terms of emissions, changed out? Another area is small auto body shops that do VOCs, volatile organic compounds, working with them on how assistance, we've provided assistance in the past to help them move to a new paint, water-based paint, or changing their spray nozzles. Those type of voluntary and financial assistance programs are two examples that Clean Air Minnesota has talked about in that regard.
Follow up, Representative Horns.
Okay, then just quickly, so how close are we to non-attainment, and what is the penalty to the region?
Commissioner Goodell.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it's going to end up depending on what that number is on the federal government on ozone. We can send the graph again, and it's going to depend on that. In terms of penalties, there isn't a specific dollar amount that the federal government or EPA would assess. It's what additional requirements are needed, the state plan, implementation plan, to bring ourselves back into compliance, and what those requirements would be. That also is going to include a lot more regulatory and permitting and paperwork for businesses. And so the number that you quoted are some of those estimates of what it would cost business. You know, the Chamber has done some estimates in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and that's what that is. It isn't a penalty, it's just the cost of bringing us back into compliance for the health care benefit.
Thank you.
Okay. Continue on.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
I'm sorry, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, is this an unfunded mandate from the federal government, or are they going to be helping businesses defray these expenses?
Commissioner Kadalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm not sure what funding sources are available. There are some programs, pre-enrollment programs and the like. I don't know what financial assistance comes with that. We can find out for you.
Continue, Commissioner. Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair and members, a couple of weeks ago when you were here, we showed you this particular graphic, which we've now added the budget request for fiscal years 16 and 17. Clearly, you can see from the chart that for the AIR program, our request is being made probably more than 90% from the Environmental Fund. With the addition of some federal funding, federal grants that are coming to the program, and then you can barely see it. There's a little bit of kind of special revenue income as well. In the next chart, we are While we are looking or coming to you and requesting funding for our entire air program, this graph illustrates the separate programs that we operate within the air program and gives you some sense of the size or the relationship of those programs to the total program. So as we talked about before, the green slice of the pie, air point source, this is going to be the stationary sources, the permits that are issued to stationary sources. Air ambient, our air monitoring effort, and air non-point source, a number of the things that we've just talked about in the committee today, including our efforts towards wood smoke, mobile source, and mobile source emissions.
So, Mr. Chair and committee members, the one change item here in the agency's budget is an increase in the appropriation, a small increase for the air program, and that is first year $200,000 and then a little more than $400,000 second biennium. The Federal Clean Air Act includes a requirement that states charge air emission fees to cover the cost of issuing permits to facilities. And part of that requirement is that the air permit fee increases to cover inflation. So the fee system is set up to collect that increase due to inflation as required under the Federal Clean Air Act. And what this request would be is to allow for the appropriation of those dollars so that the agency can use this. This is a item that comes forward every year by the agency, and the legislature and the governor have approved it every year in the past. The next issue is water. Again, just some of the work we do. Here's one of our biological monitoring teams in a watershed. And they're out there with electric shock sticks, as you can see, and we'll be measuring and weighing and also recording the species and the health of the fish that they find. And again, highlight the bottom, 99% of water permit holders are in compliance with the requirements.
Mr. Chair and members, kind of similar.
Excuse me, Mr. Mueller. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm curious about the, Mr. Kudelka, I'm curious about the watershed evaluations. Can you talk to me about the timeline it's taking to complete in 48 watersheds and how much time it will take to complete the other 35?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, because of the Clean Water Legacy dollars, we are now on a schedule to visit every watershed once every 10 years. And so this is the progress we're on. We're getting close to the end of that piece. So the goal is to be at every location every 10 years.
Follow-up. Representative Johnson.
My follow-up question would be, what would it take to speed up that a little bit?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we would have to probably do a cost estimate on it. I don't know if we have something at this point. This is a process that it would require more staff and local government grants to help with the effort.
And Commissioner Kudelka, clarify for all of us, where is the money currently coming from and what source would you need to speed up or get more of?
Mr. Chair and committee members, our 10-year cycle is funded through the Clean Water Fund, which is from the legacy dedicated sales tax increase, and that's where we would request those same dollars.
Additional follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be a hard question for you to answer, but what does it cost to evaluate a watershed, and how long does it take to do that work?
Ms. Lothheimer, welcome back. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And what we can get specific numbers about what it costs per watershed, but it really varies based on from one watershed to the next, just based on the size of the watershed. There's anywhere between 10 and 50, 75 sites, depending again on the size of the watershed that we're monitoring. And it takes 2 years to collect that enough data and information to be able to fully evaluate the health of the watershed. So we're looking at the health of the fish community, the health of the invertebrate or bug community, and then also chemistry data. And the chemistry data in particular requires a two-year time period to capture differences in weather conditions and differences from 1 year to the next, so that we're doing a good job of really recognizing what's happening in that watershed and not relying just on one particular year. We work with a lot of local governments to do that piece as well.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my follow-up question, would it be any cheaper if we just focused on one element, for instance, nitrates in the water?
Ms. Lothamer.
Mr. Chair and members, the individual costs would go down if we were just looking at one type of pollutant, but the value of the information would also decrease, because really it ends up being a combination of effects that lead to the overall health of the watershed. So to really understand what the health is and really understand what management activities are needed to either protect or restore that watershed, we need to know about the chemistry like nitrate, but we also need to know about what the fish community is looking like. We need to know about other pollutants as well, because sometimes nitrate is the issue, but sometimes it might be sediment or it might be metal or things like that. So having that more comprehensive information ends up being the most efficient way to really work through the state, understand our water resources, and then advise on what actions are needed to protect or restore.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. And do we know currently how many watersheds are impaired for nitrates and only for specifically for nitrates?
Ms. Lothamer.
Mr. Chair, members, we can get that number to you for how many water bodies are impaired for nitrates. Right now, our nitrate standard is focused on drinking waters. We don't have an aquatic life nitrate standard. That's something that is being worked on at the federal level, and as that information becomes available, then we would look at potentially developing something like that for Minnesota. That's something that we're intending to do into the future.
Thank you. Commissioner Kudelka, if I could just ask quickly, maybe you could just at a high level, it looks like you're telling me that you have, I think I can see five people in the photo, they're MPCA people that are shocking fish. Can you lay out why MPCA would be shocking fish and they wouldn't be DNR people? You have specific authority and are there for a reason. And are there also DNR people at the same time looking at the shocked fish, or are these all MPCA? They all have the same waiter, so I'm wondering if MPCA bought all those waiters. Are they all MPCA people, or do you commingle, or how's that work? Ms. Lothamer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These are all MPCA staff, although when DNR is doing work in the same watershed, we absolutely coordinate our activities. Historically, the DNR has focused on game fish population surveys, so walleye, trout, the things that people are interested in catching. For understanding the overall health of the watershed, we need to look at all of the fish species, so things down to the little tiny minnows that are part of that fish community. So the monitoring that we do is a little different, but every time we go into a watershed to do the monitoring, we actually meet with local governments, with the Department of Natural Resources, with other entities to coordinate our activities ahead of that, so that we're making sure that we're not duplicating efforts and that we're working together really well. And then the reason why this is agency staff that are doing this is because we're working with electricity, and it's something we actually have to get a permit from the DNR in order to do that. You need to do special training because you're working with electricity in water. It also takes some special education to really be able to analyze and understand what those fish species are, especially for the really small darters and minnows, things like that. So that's why those are agency staff.
But Ms. Lothamer, maybe this is a question for the commissioner. Can you explain to the committee why you're doing this kind of work and the authority and what you're looking for, as opposed to you're in the water waiting shocking fish? The natural reaction is those would be DNR people. What are you looking for? Why do you have authority in a body of water? And you had kind of, the commissioner had kind of alluded to that real quickly, and I think it could be confusing. If you could just talk about why it's you doing that kind of work and what you're actually doing there.
Mr. Chair, it's because we're looking at the overall community health, so of all of the fish, and how that relates to water quality. The DNR, when they do their surveys, focuses more on the game fish community, which is just part of that overall fish.
And Ms. Lothamer, you have authority about water quality. That's not an authority of the DNR.
Yes.
That's the point I want to make sure people understand, that water quality is an authority of the MPCA, not DNR.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. Sorry, I missed that point.
No. Well, I like to keep it simple. Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lothamer, you know, we've been kind of moving toward this biological evaluation. I'm forgetting the exact term that you utilize. How far down that path are we as we move away from just evaluating the chemistry to where we're actually evaluating how creatures are doing in our waters? Is that becoming the new standard, and how quickly?
Ms. Lothamer.
Mr. Chair and members, we are now actively evaluating the biology of our streams, and then we're actually working with the Department of Natural Resources to do the same thing for lakes. We won't ever get to the point where we don't look at chemistry at all, because the chemistry is still part of what is affecting that overall biological health. But certainly measuring the biology is the most direct way of understanding the health of our lakes and streams from a water quality standpoint.
Representative Farkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Lothamer, then how does that work into our process of declaring whether a water is impaired or not impaired?
Ms. Lothamer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, we have what are called indices of biological integrity that have been developed. They look at what a healthy community would look like in different parts of the state for different water resources. And that then is used to compare against what we're seeing in a particular water body to determine if we have a problem or an impairment. So we use those indices of biological integrity to identify where we have impaired waters. We also use the chemical standards as well, because sometimes we see a problem in the chemistry that hasn't shown up in the biology yet, but it's still a problem. We may even be able to catch it early and prevent having problems in that biological community. So those two pieces, the chemical piece and the biological piece, are really married together in that assessment process.
Thank you.
Representative Trump. Mr. Chair, so, you know, we're getting a fairly complicated process assembled here that's getting harder and harder for lay people like me to understand. And, you know, how do we approach that? How do we make it accessible to the general public?
Ms. Lothamer.
Mr. Chair and members, that's a really good point. There are more and more pieces to it. And one of the things that we've been doing with Clean Water Fund dollars, and it's actually included in part of the Clean Water Fund request this biennium as well, is working on our databases and our data information systems so that we can get information more available on the web and also translate that information so that it's more accessible to Minnesotans. We have, for example, we have a House the Water webpage that really takes that information and summarizes it for Minnesotans. And then we're working on developing a more online approach to our assessment information so that that's much more accessible as well. As we do the assessment process, we actually have a couple of steps where we involve first local resource managers that help collect that data, and then we also have a public input process or a public notice process, and we do meetings around the state to try to explain that information. We're always looking at ways to get better at conveying that information so that it gets in the hands of people that want to know about their water resources.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. Just one more question, Mr. Chair. You know, all of these natural systems are very dynamic. They change virtually daily in some cases, depending on rainfall, depending on temperature, depending on what's going on the landscape. How can we be assured that you're getting, you know, really accurate, you know, kind of long-term information rather than just a picture that may be a picture of a bad day?
Ms. Lothamer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, the standard operating procedures and the monitoring procedures that we have really try to account for that. Either, for example, with the biological monitoring, we have windows of time when we can do that monitoring, and like we can't do it when there's a flood event or when there's a drought event, because that wouldn't be representative of what's going on in a particular stream. That's also the reason for the chemistry data taking 2 years to collect, because we need to spread that out over a number of months and a number of samples, again, to get a more representative sample and not have it be weighted towards some kind of, you know, unique event.
Thank you, Ms. Lothamer. I want members to realize that there's a number of people in the agencies like Ms. Lothamer that are extremely capable and really know their stuff. So if you have interest in specific things, they have people that know about the wood burners and how they work, or this water issue. They're accessible to you through Assistant Commissioner Kadelka, and he'll certainly put you in front, and they're available to come into your office and meet with you and discuss these issues so you understand them and why we are where we are and what we're doing. So it's good discussion to have here, but you certainly, if it's of interest to you, can follow up, and thank you for coming down. And you may want to stay there. There's a long list here now. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lochnummer, I was recently informed by one of our county commissioners that, I can't remember the number, but there's five or six rivers, creeks, streams that were deemed impaired in eastern Roseau County and western Lake of the Woods County. When they're notified, is the science included with that? I was told by this commissioner that the label impaired was assigned based on one sample. You just said here a little bit ago that you spread it out and you take numerous samples. Can you provide the data to me with regards to those areas in northwest
Ms.
Minnesota
Lothamer.
That have been?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, we can provide that information.
Follow up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when you declare it impaired, do you also provide that data to the watershed or the county commissioners or whoever are involved?
Ms. Lothamer.
Mr. Chair and members, when we declare something as impaired, we do have the data available. We don't necessarily send it out because it's a lot of information along with that impaired waters list. But if folks are interested in seeing that, we absolutely have it and we make it available.
To that point, Ms. Lothamer, do you do a synopsis, a short evaluation that can be provided to them?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, we do.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Dill will be happy to hear this, too, I know. In follow-up to the questions earlier about the costs associated, I texted one of the manufacturers in my district, and they told me that the increased cost members on step one is going to be between $1,000 and $3,000, increased retail cost to the consumers on the wood-burning stoves, and that step two is basically unattainable. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, jumping back to page 22. I'm kind of a new guy on this committee, and maybe I missed it, but I'm looking at your environmental fund fiscal year 2016. You have $200,000 here, and then I'm looking at fiscal year 17, and you have $403,000. Now, that's over 100% inflationary increase. Could you shed some light on that for me?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is just the increase in the appropriation, not the total amount coming to the agency. So this is an increase off of the larger number that you see on the slide before. So that's just the incremental increase and not the full amount. So it's not a 100% increase in terms of the program from fiscal year 16 to 17.
Mr. Mueller, can you shed light on why it's twice as big in the second year than the first year?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, when we sit down and take a look at the inflationary cost increase for the program, we do so on a two-year basis rather than one year at a time. So by statute, we're directed to take a look at the consumer price increase. And it's fairly prescriptive in terms of what the time frame is that we're looking at. So we apply that change in the or increase in the CPI against the cost of the air program. That increase is then captured through the fees that we calculate, for this period of time. And so what this budget request is about is this fee, this inflationary increase in the fees will be coming into the environmental fund. We don't have the authority to automatically spend that until we come back to you and work this or bring this as a budget request through this committee.
Representative Neuberger, it's twice as big in the second year because there's 2 years inflation on it and there's only 1 year inflation on the first year. I don't know if that answers your question now. And it's only the inflationary increase for that budget. It's not the entire budget. That's what Mr. Mueller was saying. Representative Neuberger.
That's a lot of money.
Okay. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This may go back to one of our previous testifiers. This is going back to the water quality and monitoring system, as I know that when we were hearing the discussion before, it was revolving a lot more around things that we see in our dashboard, the phosphates, the nitrates, et cetera. And I was wondering, as the water is being evaluated, what are other things that they look at in terms of chemicals or even things that might be pharmaceuticals, et cetera, that are ending up more in the water supply and what kind of damage it does and what kind of standards are we using? How do we, you know, we can see where we're improving or not improving on the phosphates and nitrates here, but I'm wondering what are the other chemicals out there or pharmaceuticals that we should be keeping an eye out and trying to pay that same attention to, and how does that impact us?
Ms. Lotthammer.
Mr. Chair and members, you know, we have a long list of the chemicals that we're monitoring for, including the pharmaceuticals and personal care products. I wonder if it might be most efficient if we just provide that to the committee. And
that'd be great. Okay. Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd look forward to seeing that information. And the other question I have, do any of those approach an area of showing the waters being impaired because of any of those chemicals? We're always seeing the impairments for phosphates, nitrates, but are, you know, is there a list that we're seeing in some of these other areas that we should also be aware of?
So Ms. Lotthammer.
Mr. Chair and members, we can also get you the list of the current impaired waters and what they're impaired for, kind of an aggregate of what they're impaired for. One thing that I would like to mention is that for a lot of the pharmaceuticals, personal care products, some of those contaminants of emerging concern, there aren't currently water quality standards that have been developed for those yet. You know, we have some chemicals that we can measure at very low concentrations, but the studies haven't all been completed about what the effects are. So while we're monitoring for those and we're looking at trends over time, we're not assessing those for impairment because we don't have the standards to compare them against. And if I could just clarify one more item from earlier.
What would you do if I said no? No. Go ahead.
I would do what you told me to do, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Representative Fabian had a question about if we assess based on one standard or one sample. And I do want to clarify that there are some situations where we do. For example, for mercury impairments for fish, we may have one sampling event where we go and take fish, we take a number of fish and then analyze those for mercury. But because mercury is a pollutant that accumulates over time, it's not going to vary from 1 year to the next. And so we feel that it's appropriate to then make an impairment decision based on that one sample because of the conditions associated with that type of pollutants.
Just Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you were mentioning before about chemicals where there are no standards, if we start, how do we determine at what point does it become a problem, and who makes that determination? Is that something that goes through the MPCA and they go to their board to figure this out? How do these things get established?
We hope they don't go to their board for this. Ms. Lotthammer.
Mr. Chair and members, there are a couple of different ways. In some cases, there may be studies that are happening at the federal level to provide guidance through the Environmental Protection Agency. Two states for looking at standards. Other states may be developing standards, and we become aware of that. In the case of pharmaceuticals and personal care products, we actually, last biennium, received an appropriation from the legislature that's allowing us to start to develop what we call screening values. They're not standards. They're not intended to be standards, but they use information to get a sense for, you know, comparing what we're seeing in the environment against these numbers to see if there might be an issue. And if there was an issue, then we could look at proceeding with the standards development process. But that would take many years of collecting the information and doing the studies, things like that.
Thank you. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of things, just following up on things that I heard and I, some comments and questions. And I had, first thing, I just heard about mercury in fish, and haven't done some of those analyses over the last 35 years. I you know, that varies from fish to fish. I think everybody knows that, and from species to species. But Ms. Lotthammer pointed out, when you're looking at one particular year, you're going to see what's there. So And it's still an issue for us, eh? And I know some of us in this room have talked about it. We did a good job in Minnesota. Now we got to talk about what's coming from overseas for mercury. But the Representative Barkelson, I heard something about that, and I just want to comment on this, if you'll indulge me, on the where we're at when we look at all the critters, et cetera, and the words that I haven't heard here yet this morning, and maybe I missed it, with designated uses that we have for our waters, and that's kind of the backdrop for a lot of this, and in some instances, it's a class, you know, that's of designated use that's just recreational. Well, you can, you know, you can water ski on a pond scum, you know, a little pothole if you want, if you got enough distance to do it. But what we're looking for, at least up my neck of the woods and the waters, is can we have walleye or are we going to have bullheads? And so it's the outcome of all those critters that are supporting that food chain. Is it a food chain we want for our tourists to fish? Granted, some of the folks from Iowa will come up and they're just happy catching bullheads. And that's cool, you know, because some of our lakes have. And no disrespect to our southern neighbor.
But you're right.
But many of us like to catch walleye, you know, and maybe stick a big northern now and again when we're out there in our spear house. The designated use, and that's what, and can we get, and Mr. Chair, I heard you allude to it, can we get MPCA and DNR to focus on designated uses in a coordinated fashion with everybody that wants to try and do that? Because I think we have some opportunities. So I just wanted to bring up the designated uses. Thank you.
Good point, Representative Purcell. We're back to continuing. Go ahead, Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair and members, you've seen this graphic before, with the exception of we've added, again, 16 and 17. Previously, we talked about the big change on this the series of bar charts represents the kind of the diminishing of the importance of the general fund and the existence, starting in fiscal 10, of the Clean Water Fund as a source of funding for our water program. On to the next slide. Again, doing the same thing that we did with the air program, what we're trying to illustrate is the range of range and mix of programs that are funded and carried out through our water program.
Mr. Chair, and committee members, the change item request for the MPCA in this area deals with the Clean Water Fund. So a quick background, every 2 years under the legacy dollars, they're one-time appropriations, so they're not built into the base. So every 2 years, agencies that are seeking funds from the Clean Water Fund have to come back and re-request those dollars. And so you see our request here for just over $29 million in each of the fiscal years, and the list of the items that the agency is requesting. And Mr. Chair, I don't know how much of this you would like us to go in detail on this versus in the legacy committee, but I can do it very quickly on a high level and gauge where you'd like more info.
You know, Commissioner Kadalka, we're going to hear the bill here, so okay. If you want to keep it at a real high level, I believe Representative Torkelson is author of that part of the bill, and it will be before here. To this point, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what I'd be interested in, Commissioner, is the difference between the governor's recommendation and the Clean Water Council's recommendation. So you don't have to go through that line by line, but if you could get that to the committee later, that'd be fine.
You know, Commissioner Kadalka, why don't you give us that now, though? I think that's a good point, Representative Hansen. That would be good to get that before, because if I'm not mistaken, when we hear Representative Torkelson, your bill, it will be the recommendations of the council, not the governor's. Am I correct in that?
Mr. Chair, I have not written a bill yet, so
you're
on the right track.
Okay, well, you're on that council, and you're not on the governor's staff, so I made an assumption there that I shouldn't have. Commissioner Kadalka, maybe this will be rather tough to do then. Representative Hansen was right. Continue at a high level.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we will provide you a spreadsheet with the differences for you, but we'll go on a high level here. The first two items are the work that we talked about already. It's part of that measuring, assess, plan, and do the watershed approach that we talked about a couple weeks ago. And this is the start of that process. And the MPCA is the lead in those areas where we're monitoring and assessing our watersheds on a 10-year cycle. Previously, before the legacy dollars were available, we were on a system where we would be out of water every 100 years or so was the time frame. So we've been able to greatly accelerate the dollars because of the legacy dollars. The second item then is our watershed restoration and protection strategies, also known as RAPs. And this is where we put together the information and provide this to local units of government and other agencies, and then put together implementation plans. So these dollars are items that the agency has asked for previously, and there are only some small differences between the Clean Water Council recommendations and these. The third item is groundwater assessment on water quality issues. This is a partnership of a number of agencies, and the portion that the MPCA really handles with our network is dealing with more non-agricultural areas and non-agricultural chemicals. And an example of that is chloride and road salts, those kind of things where we do a lot of work in that area. Second to last bullet deals with county programs. There are some dollars that are provided through the regular funding to counties to help with the operating their septic system programs. There's a partnership between the state and the county on the implementation of this. And with, when the Clean Water Legacy Act was created, there was also the determination of the need for counties to receive the funds to make sure that they can improve their services, their permitting, their inspections, and making sure we don't have straight pipes and other imminent threats to public health systems out there. The last item is one of those restoration projects that many of you may have heard of. It's the St. Louis River Area of Concern, where we're working on a large area that's listed on a federal basis, where we are going through and building the plan to clean up a number of polluted sites, not only the water itself and the estuary, St. Louis River Estuary in Duluth, but properties next to it. This is matched with federal dollars so that the amount of money that's actually received through the agency from the feds is more than double than what we put in as a state.
Commissioner Kadalka, can you, I have two questions in regard to this slide. At a high level, can you tell the committee what's the justification for spending about half this money on what I would call evaluation, monitoring, assessment, and then half on actually fixing stuff? Just talk to us why, yeah, we need to spend $30 million over the next 2 years on evaluation and not on fixing stuff. Could you touch on sure. how actually where this is wise use? Commissioner Kadalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, two things to note. These dollars are the MPCA's portion of the larger Clean Water Fund recommendation. And if you look at all agencies monitoring assessment and also the watershed restoration protection strategies, over the all agencies and all, the whole request, it's only 23%. The rest is going into other activities, including what you mentioned, our implementation. A lot of those activities, if we are in the larger chart, we do the assessment and put together the data to help drive what other folks are doing. So large amounts of the to-do are done by other agencies such as DNR and the Board of Water and Soil Resources. So this is a snapshot of that.
Commissioner, I guess when you come back and we hear Representative Torkelson's bill, which I'm sure will have bipartisan authors on the bill, so I don't want to refer to it as only Representative Torkelson, but I know that he'll be one of the authors on the bill. I want you to give us some examples. Here's some money we spent on assessment and evaluation that allowed us to more strategically spend the money on the ground. Just some good, show some good return on investment for some of those assessment dollars. And then one other one, there's $2.9 million for groundwater assessment. Specifically, this is monitoring wells. Are these the same wells that DNR is monitoring, or are you drilling different wells? Are they in the same geographic area? And are you not using each other's wells, or how does that work? Commissioner Kadalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, on a very high level, DNR is looking at the quantity of water. We're looking at quality. And we partner with the DNR, Department of Ag, and others so that we are doing these. And when we're placing wells, we're doing it in conjunction so that if they can be, we can create a nest of wells that are multiple purposes. So there is that coordination. It's a good thing to highlight is that we are working together on that, but there are we're looking for different types of data.
And then again, Commissioner, when your folks yeah. come back, if they could identify, here is the spot where we actually are drilling a separate well, and it's only for us because of these reasons. Again, just as we kind of look at it at a high level. Commissioner or Mr. Mueller, continue.
Mr. Chair, the next one is highlighted is our database in water research. This is, as Ms. Lothammer talked about, making sure that all the data that not only the MPCA collects on this is available to other agencies and the public and local units of government. The next couple items really are dealing with looking at, in the case of where there are regulated industries, ways to make sure and research investments on making things more effective, not only in terms of environmental outcomes and public health outcomes, but also costs. In the, for instance, wastewater treatment system designs, appropriations from 2 years ago, we put out three pilot projects to help determine and test new technologies that would reduce more phosphorus, for example, are some of the test examples that we're using to reduce the cost and improve the bang for our dollars. Same goes with the stormwater research. And the second to last bullet deals with the work that's done on the regulatory issue. We talked about the cycle of measuring, planning, and then doing. When we put together the RAPs, it puts together a number of strategies and areas where we need to address. Non-point sources, urban or ag runoff, those are things that are handed off to local units of government or Bowser to work on, but there may be some strategies that deal with regulated parties. That information is what the agency takes and works through its permitting program, and so that these are dollars along those efforts. And the last is the agency is the fiscal agent for the Clean Water Council, and there's an appropriation there for its continuing operation.
Commissioner, thank you. I'm wondering, is there someone of the folks you brought with that knows the MPDS permit in process and the requirements for from the feds? We require them, if 1 acre of total disturbance is going to happen, we're required to get an MPDS permit. Oftentimes, these are public bodies that are paying that fee, and if I'm not mistaken, it starts at $400. Is that a federal requirement that it be 1 acre, or is that a state requirement? Is there a reason why we can't? Because that's total disturbance. I mean, I've heard of folks that on a tree planting project, because you're disturbing X amount of square footage per tree, that you actually have to get an NPDS permit, and that's the local units of government oftentimes paying that. Is there anyone that knows the answer to that?
Mr. Chair and committee members, it is a federal requirement.
And is there a waiver process on the 1 acre?
Mr. Chair, we'll double check, but we don't believe so.
The nods look no. Okay, thank you. Continue.
For that, Mr. Chair, we'll move on to our third budget area, and that is land. And this is the type of programs you think of, our solid waste, recycling, and also our cleanup programs. There is just one correction on the bullet. As we have put this slide this presentation together 2 days ago, we are also in the process of updating our dashboard, and so there's a correction in terms of that third. There hasn't been the large reduction there of 90%. There has been a slight decrease, but we'll get you updated numbers on that. But we just wanted to make sure someone didn't quote something that was incorrect. The picture here is our closed landfill work. This is the East Mesabi landfill in St. Louis County outside Virginia, where we are have put together, reduced the footprint for 25% of the garbage, put in 30 vents for methane and other types of air emissions, and 15 solar flares, and then the cover on top to make sure that we protect for water quality.
Commissioner, in this back to that slide, is the material you're covering below that liner, or is the liner in place and you're going to put material on top of that liner?
Mr. Chair and committee members, in this case, the material that's on the top to create a cover on top so that rainwater doesn't go through the soil, through the waste underneath, and create and to leachate and create groundwater issues. You are correct, though. There are some landfills in the closed landfill program and modern landfills that require liners on the bottom to collect that. But in this case, it's just this is the cover on top.
And Commissioner, you will put a cover on top, an earthen cover on top of the fabric cover we see there, and then that'll naturally use most of the water up that lands on it, and only the water that leaches into the system and then will be handled. Would that be appropriate or correct?
Mr. Chair, correct. This is covered, and there are soils and then vegetation on top.
Thank you. Continue.
Mr. Chair and members, kind of again following the same pattern of kind of a look at the history of funding for the land program. Clearly, you can see that for the land program, the largest funding piece of the pie is the remediation fund funding. Going back a number of years, there used to be a small amount of general fund funding that is now gone, and environmental funds, federal funds, have been very stable over this time period. Kind of same pattern, taking a look at the overall land program, and then displaying the various programs that are funded through our land program.
So, Mr. Chairs, we're...
Oh, time out, sorry. Commissioner, back to the land program. I had asked yesterday if you could have somebody come and talk about, would this be the appropriate time for the closed landfill investment fund? So, yeah.
Mr. Chair and committee members, yes, it would be. We can do that right now.
If it's not appropriate, the only thing I'm thinking that might take a little while.
Yeah, this works perfectly. Just a little bit of background, and then I've got Kathy Mogar, one of our division directors, here to talk about the history. The closed landfill investment program, what the chair's talking about, was created in 1999. The state, through a process, created the closed landfill program, and you see one of those closed landfills here, where the state took over the operation and care long-term for 112 eligible landfills. These were landfills that were done early on in the process, and now they are... we have taken them over and many times redesigned them to make sure to eliminate the risk moving forward, but there are still costs moving forward in terms of monitoring and operation, and also in terms of contingency actions, things we may learn of. For instance, in one of ours, we've learned of hazardous waste being buried in a cell that we weren't, is now creating problems that we need to go back on, those type of contingency actions. And these are for old landfills. Moving forward, landfills that are permitted today are required under federal and state law to have financial assurances, so that we are really dealing with legacy issues there that will not go away. And as a result, the legislature in 1999 created the Closed Landfill Fund, which would help for the ongoing costs, operation and maintenance, and also those contingency actions. And it was seeded by four payments of $5.1 million from the Solid Waste Fund, which was a collection of insurance recovery dollars, solid waste taxes, and a number of other sources. When the fund was created, legislation also said those dollars could not be used by the state until 2020. The idea was for the growth of that principal through investment to continue to grow so that it can meet the long-term needs. And that's just a quick overview. With that, I'm going to turn it over to our division director to talk more about the history at the legislation at the time.
Director Mulger, welcome. And if you could identify yourself for the record and then give us some historical perspective, that would be appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kathy Mulger. I'm currently the operations division director, but this testimony is based on my work with the legislature from 1999 to 2003 in the solid waste program, and then later as the agency's chief financial officer. So I worked with the environmental finance committees to create this closed landfill investment fund that was supposed to provide a guaranteed source of income that could be used to address basically perpetual liability for the 106 closed landfills at that time that were under the state's ownership or responsibility. The PCA was also authorized to invest a portion of the solid waste fund with the State Board of Investment to cover that long-term contingency that Mr. Kadelka was talking about. In 2001, the Office of the Legislative Auditor asked the agency to begin preparing future obligation memos that contained the estimated costs of dealing with these landfills, and the estimate at that first obligation memo was $285 million. So as Mr. Kadelka indicated, Cliff Closed Landfill Investment Fund was created in 1999. We transferred $5.1 million from the Solid Waste Fund for 4 years, fiscal year 2000 through 2003. The transfers were able to occur because we were having increased revenue to the Solid Waste Fund from insurance recovery settlements. For the closed landfills, part of the program was suing insurance companies to recover costs for the landfills that they had insured. And so that gave us a source of revenue to take care of those landfills. At that time, it was about $25 million. So it was pretty close to what was transferred. Later, in the FY 04 and 05 budget request adopted by the legislature, 50% of the settlements starting in fiscal year 2002 were set aside in this closed landfill investment fund, and 50% went into the remediation fund so we could deal with the immediate needs of the closed landfills. In 2003, we had recovered about $30 million from these insurance companies. We had remaining lawsuits outstanding for 13 carriers, and basically the settlement agreement said if you settle with the state of Minnesota, we will fund closed landfill remediation and perpetual care, and you will be released from covering those response actions. At that time, we were under a budget crisis or needing to shore up the general fund, and there were transfers of $73 million from the Solid Waste Fund, the Environmental Fund, and Remediation Fund balances to cover those deficits. And the consideration of the funding in the closed landfill fund came up. At that time, the defendant insurance companies started questioning whether or not the state of Minnesota was actually going to assume perpetual care of the facilities because of the concern about the transfers. In 2003, I testified that the loss in principal and interest at that time, 8.5%, by taking $10.9 million in principal from the closed landfill investment fund would eventually result in a loss of $40 million to the closed landfill investment fund by 2020.
Ms. Mulger, if I can just stop you on that point, I want to clarify. So in 03, you noted that if they took $10 million out of that fund, that would have a consequence of $40 million in the future. Was that money taken out in 03?
No, I was actually just going to say
go ahead,
Mr. Chair. So the legislature actually chose not to divert money from the closed landfill fund, both because of the loss of the interest in the account that would fund perpetual care, and also concern about a potential $20 million loss from the remaining 13 carriers that we were trying to settle with.
Okay, and do you remember, Ms. Mulger, was your anticipation when you talked about the $10 million and the potential $40 million cost, was that in relation to, at that time, the 8.5% assumed interest rate out to 2020? Is that how you had arrived at that number?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you. If you could continue.
Mr. Chair, that concludes my testimony.
Well, you're missing a portion here from 03 till 2015. Do you mind continuing, or did you disappear during that time?
Mr. Chair, I stopped working in this area soon after that.
Okay. Commissioner Kudelka, are you going to fill in the happenings from then?
Mr. Chair, I will fill in then from 2010, where we pick up this story again. In 2010,
Commissioner Kudelka, excuse me. From 03, Ms. Mulger, can you tell me where was the money in 03? How much was it, and where was it invested?
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I don't have that information with me. I won't hazard a guess.
Ms. Mulgrew, if I kind of have a grasp on it, by 03, all four payments had been made, the $5 million each had been made, and I'm wondering, do you know if the money in 03 was invested with the investment folks here at the state of Minnesota? It wasn't in a 0.25% savings book interest.
Mr. Chair, that's correct, and that's why I didn't want to hazard a guess, was because it was the original principal that was transferred from the fund, and then the assumption at that time from the State Board of Investment was an 8.5% growth rate.
And if I'm not mistaken, Ms. Morgan, you're telling me that basically about in the middle of this investment time was 2001, and if I'm remembering right, that was when we had one of the crashes in the stock market. So if you could get back to us just how that fund progressed until you left in 03, and then Commissioner Kudelka, if you could pick up. So it's my understanding the money's invested in a fund in 03, and basically at that time there was no big payments coming in, but potentially, Commissioner, if you could address what money, or Ms. Mulgrew, if you know what money moved into the fund, because I think some small amounts moved in. Were they insurance settlements, or were the Ms. Mulgrew?
Mr. Chair, that's actually what I was going to point out, is we eventually did settle with the insurance carriers that were outstanding, and so we did receive insurance settlements that were done in a 50-50 split. 50% went into the closed landfill investment fund, and the other 50% of those insurance settlements went into the remediation fund to deal with the day-to-day needs of the closed landfill program.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mulgrew, just a kind of a follow-up on that, this was my question was regard, you said settlements from insurance companies, and you talked about suing the insurance companies. One of the questions I was going to ask is the number of dollars that you receive in those settlements or that are awarded, do they need to be reappropriated by the legislature when those dollars are awarded?
Ms. Mulgrew.
Mr. Chair and members, the portion that goes into the closed landfill investment fund is not yet available to us. By statute, we cannot access that money until 2020. The portion that was deposited into the remediation fund is appropriated to us by you, the legislature.
Follow-up, Representative Fagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. So by what mechanism or what authority is that money split 50-50 between the closed landfill fund and the remediation fund? Is that just something that's done internally, or is there legislation that did that?
Ms. Mulgrew.
Mr. Chair and members, that was done by statute. There was legislation that created that split as part of the restructuring of our environmental and remediation funds.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then also, if there is dollars being sought in the form of a lawsuit, do these go to trial, or is there basically just an out-of-court settlement?
Ms. Mulgrew, I'm just going to jump in real quick. Representative Fabian, for those of you that were in the private sector and had delivered material to dumps or landfills, I always call them dumps, sorry, in the 70s, it was a very interesting process. We were contacted by MPCA and asked if, yes, did you chose the records that you hauled stuff to the landfill? Did you have insurance? What did you deliver there? There was all kinds of things as they sought insurance settlements, not only from the landfill operators, but all the businesses that delivered things to those landfills. And so it was a very extensive effort on behalf of the state of Minnesota to go after people that may have deposited things in dumps. And it was an effort to go after their insurance companies. And I think that's, for the most part, completely done now. Or are the two or three landfills that haven't gone into the program, is there still a potential that you're working with those insurance companies and those operators to reach financial settlements? You can get back to us, or Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair, we'll have to get back to you with that information.
So, I mean, there was 119 or whatever that you've closed, and there's two or three that are still outstanding to be closed. For the most part, this is something that happened back in, my goodness, it must have been in the 80s when you were actually doing this, because it was asking about work that or things we brought to the dump in the 70s and 80s. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last question. If you do need legal counsel on these, which I assume you do, do you use your own MPCA attorneys? Do you have people on retainer? If they're private, do they get a cut in the settlement? How are they compensated?
Ms. Mulgrew, do you remember how that was done?
Mr. Chair, I think we, with the permission of the State Attorney General's office, there was an outside law firm that was hired to do that work for on behalf of the state of Minnesota, and they did receive compensation for that work. I would have to go back and find records to be able to know how much.
And if Representative Fabian needs more than that, he'll get to you offline, Commissioner Kadalka. It's important for folks to know the perspective of this. There's three general fund payments are proposed in statute. They're not proposed. They're in statute to be made in each of the next 3 years, and those payments are approximately $12 million of general fund. That's why we're trying to understand what was this all about from 1998. And Ms. Mulgrew has brought us through 2003 with a little bit of snapshot after that. And Commissioner Kadalka, if you want to move forward from that time frame. Ms. Mulgrew, you may want to stay close by.
So, Mr. Chair and committee members, in between that time, as mentioned by Ms. Mulgrew, there was an additional insurance recoveries made. And then we'll fast forward the story to 2010, where another budget deficit arose, and there was discussions on using dollars from the the closed landfill investment fund. And what was done at that time, the legislature and the governor at the time enacted a transfer of $48 million from the closed landfill fund and used that to help with the budget deficit at the time. At the same time, put in the law was the promise of a repayment in four payments starting in 2014 back to the closed landfill fund, and also include that the total amount of interest and other earnings that would have accrued to the fund if the transfer had not been made. And as the chair mentioned, the first payment on that was made this summer to the closed landfill fund of just under $10 million, which was the principal portion of the $48 million. And at the same time, MMB made up the loss in potential accrued investment earnings of that time, which was just a little bit more than $51 million. So at this time, the closed landfill fund balance is $66.2 million. Now, those dollars are in the fund. They cannot be used under statute to 2020 and only for certain uses, including the ongoing operation and maintenance of the 112 closed landfills in the program, and would need to be appropriated by the legislature at that time.
And Mr. Kadalka, can you tell us, or maybe you need to get back to us, how was the money invested from 03 to 010? I guess I would like to see that, how it was invested, and how were any payments along that time invested, and maybe a timeline of the additional payments along the line. And I guess actually the whole time it would be good. Give us from the beginning, you know, the 5.1 payments in the first 4 years, and then any additional along the timeline up to 2010 when the $48 million went out, and then just because I know there is some question of whether it was invested with MMB in the investment route, or was some of it at certain times, some was also invested as an interest-bearing account. And members should also know that the language and statute when the money was taken in 2010, the $48 million said it would be returned with interest, not with investment income. But MMB interpreted that they should return it with investment income, and I think some of the rationale was because it had been invested with investments with MMB over the years. Commissioner Kadalka or Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair, real quick, just on the statutory language, and it is written into the language, other earnings that would have accrued to the fund if the transfer to the general fund under this paragraph had not been made. And so that language is in there. It's not just interest, and that's where the state and MMB made that investment calculation from.
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair and members, just very, we will provide a spreadsheet starting in 1999 and running through current. In that time frame, from 2003 until the time of the loan, money in the fund, the process, the normal process is as the insurance recovery money would come in, it would come into the CLIF fund, which is held in the state treasury. Staff at MPCA would work with SBI. The money would be moved in to an account at SBI, still coded to the closed landfill investment fund, but then it would be invested outside of the state treasury in the equity market. And at that point in time, from really the start of the fund in 1999 through the time of the loan, the investments were made at 100% in the stock market, in equities in the stock market. You are correct in that at different points in time, there's money that is in CLIF that's held at MMB. That money essentially would be considered to be in transition or in transit until it kind of falls under the control of SBI and then would be invested, as I said, in equities.
But Mr. Mueller and Mr. Hagemeyer, correct me if I'm wrong, there was a few times in there where the money sat for years without being moved to the investment fund. Is that correct, Mr. Mueller?
Mr. Chair and members, you may be referring to there was an insurance recovery money or payment rather in the neighborhood of $3 million that came into CLIF in the state treasury, and it was after the loan had been transacted, and that money remained in CLIF but at MMB and therefore earned a rate of interest, something referred to as ITC, which is investment treasury cash. It's a short-term investment rate. So that money did remain in CLIF but at MMB until this payment or the repayment had been made from the general fund, the first payment and interest. Now everything is back with SBI and again, once again invested. The change in the, at this point, PCA has worked with SBI and changed the investment strategy, and this is at the encouragement of MMB. So it is now a 70% invested in equities and 30% in fixed income.
Mr. Mueller, will you repeat that? I'm not sure I followed what you just said. You said 70% in equities and it's 30% in bonds?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Yeah, you said fixed equities. Okay, thank you.
Fixed income, I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank you. Ms. Mulger, if I could ask you, back in 1999, what did MPCA envision when they came forward with this idea of that we were going to need some money in 2020? You mentioned an OLA report that said that their total accumulated costs in the future, something you, if I had it written down, $285 million. Were those costs incurred post-2020, or were they the total cost, including the remediation fund work? Ms. Mulger, and I'm sorry, it's Director Mulger. I'm sorry, you've earned it. Go ahead, Director.
Mr. Chair and members, the concern at the time was that the money in the solid waste fund would not be adequate in order to be able to fund what is essentially the post-closure care of these landfills. So the period of time that we were looking at was basically the post closure care, if that makes sense. So after a landfill closes for 20 years, even now for open sites, they're required to put away money to fund all the monitoring and everything that has to happen to take care of that landfill. After that period of time, there's a financial assurance that covers those sites in the open solid waste landfills. In the closed landfills, that became CLIF, the Closed Landfill Investment Fund. So that funds that post 20-year period, and then at that time we took the Office of Legislative Auditor's recommendation that we project out for 30 years. So that's a 30-year estimate after the 20-year post-closure period, if that makes sense.
Well, Ms. Mulgrew, I want to understand. So it doesn't kick in until 20 years after each individual landfill was closed. So if an individual landfill closed in 2010, none of this money would be used at that facility till 2030?
Mr. Chair, I probably confused everything by mentioning open landfills, but the sites that we're dealing with have been closed for decades. So
Director Mulgrew, this would be all the cost incurred after 2020 for all of the closed ones, but would it also include the two or three that haven't been closed yet, or would those costs not be included for 20 years from whenever they close? Or because I thought you said there's some, if you could answer that, Director Mulgrew.
Mr. Chair and members, if we have not signed a binding agreement with a facility, they are not in our cost estimates.
And Ms. Mulgrew, did you say they're required to fund the monitoring for the first 20 years after they're closed, after the work is done in that landfill?
Mr. Chair, in our open solid waste program, so those facilities that are in operation now, yes, they're putting aside money with every amount of waste that's tipped at their facilities to pay for that.
Okay, I got confused. It's a different issue. Thank you. Representative Fabian, I think I'm good at this point. No? Okay. Ms. Mulgrew, thank you for that. And then I don't think I got to with a question. I'm sorry. What was envisioned in 1999 that we would be doing post-2020? And I remind members, there's nothing in statute today about how to spend the money in 2020. Ms. Mulgrew, what was envisioned, if you don't mind, and I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but I'd have to go find Representative Holson and Representative Osman to get more historical perspective, which maybe I will be doing. Director Mulgrew.
Mr. Chair and members, the vision at the time was that we knew we had these long-term operation and maintenance costs, which Mr. Kadelka has talked about. So that's the water monitoring, repairing erosion issues. We also knew that we may have things that we had not discovered or that became problems, and we call those contingency actions, like the hazardous waste pit that Mr. Kadelka mentioned. I think most recently Washington County might be a good example of a closed landfill where there were issues that were unanticipated at the time that we did the final work and closure of that closed landfill. So that was the idea, is that we would set aside a principal of money that could grow with the State Board of Investment to cover these costs after 2020.
Thank you. Additional question? No. Thank you for that perspective. Mr. Mueller and Commissioner Kadelka, if you want to continue.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe we've looked at this chart. I think we're ready to go to the next.
Sorry, Mr. Chair and committee members, the next change item in the agency's budget deals with our Superfund and petroleum sites. Our commissioner is very fond of saying what I once knew, and this really pertains to this issue. As we learn more and our information becomes better on what pollutants and their impacts on public health, standards are updated or new risks are discovered, and we are now in the situation in example of soil vapors, which we've talked about a couple weeks ago, but also updates in the drinking water standard for TCE, trichloroethylene, which is a degreaser, has made us re-examine a number of our property polluted sites. And so we're going back to active sites to do this investigation, but also previously closed out sites to go back and look at the issue of soil vapors, which for just a quick reminder is where there's a plume underneath in the groundwater. The chemicals volatilize, work their way up through the soil pores and into basements, and that's where the potential impact of public health is. Last year, the legislature helped with a one-time appropriation for increased dollars for our Superfund programs to look at existing and also closed sites to go back and do and make sure that the public health is protected. This change item asks for the dollars to be moved into the next 2 years and into the base for the remediation program. In addition, there are 750 petroleum sites that we've identified that also need to be looked at, previous sites, to determine if there are soil vapor issues there. And so there's a request for, as you can see from the petroleum fund, to allow for that work to do to maintain staff that in that area. The final issue deals with prevention, and that's making sure that we don't come across these problems again in the future. And that is a recommendation for some dollars going to the petroleum fund dealing with inspections. Currently, that we are in a process of visiting every underground storage tank once every 3 years. A lot of that work was funded by federal dollars. Those dollars have been cut by 34% and from the feds. And the proposal here is to maintain two of those folks that were previously funded by federal dollars through state dollars. Going back to the questions on FTEs, what this does is it would allow for us, the agency, to maintain staff, eight staff moving forward that were in previous budgets as one-time funding, but move them continually into the future.
Commissioner Kudelka, if we could, and I think this is probably as far as we'll get today. Is this the only change item? And then we move into an environmental assistance across media, just so that it would free up your land and water. We've done or land and air. We've done and water. We've done all three of those divisions. So I'm just thinking, in respect to your folks coming back next Tuesday, that hopefully those people then would need to feel they need to come. But we will have that discussion, just as we're conscious of all the people that you have to bring in. Commissioner Kudelka, this fund was originally intended. Many of us have dealt in our own district with gas stations, and I think some of the members, including myself, have had personal experience with this, where property that had a former gas station, for lack of a better term, underground tanks, and in the old days they were, generally speaking, plain steel tanks that were put in the ground, and unfortunately over years they leaked oftentimes and they didn't have leak detection on them. Today the modern tanks are protected with leak detection systems and sometimes are fiberglass, not steel. They're coated with material today so they don't leak as much. But we have years ago this fund was set up. It's a 2 cent blink on, blink off tax on gasoline that when the money is needed to fund this program, its original intent was to allow so the gas stations didn't have to pay the huge cost or gas station owners. And there's actually a program that then holds the future landowners harmless of any liability, so it allowed sales transactions on those lands to happen. The department is requesting that those original intents be expanded to cover, in some cases, you had sites where you cleaned up, you thought you had cleaned them up to the level necessary, and what you're saying now is there's a potential, one item is vapor intrusion may be happening, and you may want to go back and you want to spend some money to monitor and go back to those sites that supposedly were already done. But Commissioner, doesn't this also expand into, is there an effort to potentially look at dry cleaning sites with this petroleum checkoff money, Commissioner Kadalka?
Mr. Chair and committee members, there is a separate dry cleaner fund that is set up to deal with that. There are charges on the chemicals used by dry cleaners to help. It's similar to the petro fund that you were just describing, but it's a different account. We do not have a request in there to do anything different. The petroleum fund request here will just cover two pieces. Any site that has, as you mentioned, issues with petroleum products dealing with soil vapors, or the inspection dollars for those to maintain those two staff because of federal cuts. Those are the only things that would come from the petro fund. The other dollars for Superfund sites, which a dry cleaner could fall under, or our other programs that deal with polluted sites, may be using the remediation fund. So there wouldn't be any dollars for that were going into the petrol fund from that 2 cents fee you mentioned on gas going to dry cleaners. The two different funds, depending on the site, if it's a petroleum gas site, we would use money from the petrol fund. If it is a dry cleaner or some other industrial chemical issue, we would use the remediation fund, or if there is a responsible party, they would be liable for those costs.
Thank you for that clarification, Commissioner. So it's just the expansion of the ability to look at different things than what the fund was originally intended. You're not going out to things that aren't in the petroleum industry.
Mr. Chair, correct. The inspections would be a new use of the funds. And you're right, it would not be anything outside petroleum. It's for the underground petroleum tanks.
Thank you. Representative Ugel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, quick question for you with the dry cleaners. Trichloroethylene has been outlawed for many years now. Isn't there a decreasing demand for cleanup with regard to this particular industry?
Commissioner, I do want to say we are going to hear a bill dealing with that issue. So if you want to hit on it on a high level, because the dry cleaners are proposing to do some funding on their own, and I believe also there's a potential bill that deals with some general fund requests. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, dry cleaners deal with PERC, which is the chemical that's used in a number of dry cleaners. Some of them still do that. I mentioned before the dry cleaner fund has sources of funding in there. Depending on if you use PERC, that's a higher fee that goes into that fund, and less environmental risk chemicals have a lower amount. And so to your point, dry cleaners, some of them are moving to the less risk type for various reasons, their own worker safety, but also for the reduction in cost. So we have been seeing that. However, we know much more now about these, and the sites, they keep on giving, unfortunately, and we're learning more about them. Just recently, we contacted the community because of an old dry cleaner, which is now a law firm, and that it is, we are now going in and having to look at 35 to 40 properties as a result of the soil vapor. So while today's usage on that chemical may be slightly decreasing, we are learning more and have more cleanups just because of legacy actions. In terms of the dry cleaner account in general, the dollars are set up, and we can get you some more details on this when the bill comes up. A certain amount comes into the fund, and that amount then is drives. What has happened is the dry cleaners have said instead of them being named an individual responsible party, they have decided to pool together under this fund in case there is a cleanup action. The amount of money coming in from the fees is much less than the amount of money needing to go out in terms of cleanup. The difference, there is a slight difference between the petrol fund and the dry cleaner account. The petrol fund will only clean up properties to its current usage. The dry cleaner fund allows for also cleanup to its current usage, but also allows for development. So if it goes from which was a commercial to a residential, and cleanup standards have to be increased, or there's a there, that's also done. And so unfortunately, the requests for reimbursements coming into that area are growing much more than the funds going in, and as a result, it's creating a waiting list to get those reimbursements, which the chair has talked about, the industry has mentioned.
Thank you.
Many
folks. Okay, thank Representative you. Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because we're closing, I was going to ask you for some information the next time we come. In your chart here, you talk about the fact that the waters are cleaner now. They've been continually getting better in the last 20 years. So I know I'm jumping back. Mm-hmm. But do you have a chart showing the progression of that? So if I could get that. Also, back on page 22, it was alluded to on the administrating, this is an error, inflation cost of administration. In 16 and 17, is this an increase in wages, inflationary, you know, wages for FTEs? Or is it new hires, or is it something else? I'd like to get that. And also, if you could let me know what your total proposals for new FTEs are through 2017.
And Mr. Mueller, can you address the second concern? I think you could answer that. Is it an inflationary increase? How was it arrived at that number? Do you have the answer for that?
Mr. Chair and Representative, it is an inflationary increase across whole program costs. So we would take a look at what that rate of inflation was based on the CPI, and that would be applied to the whole cost of delivering the air program.
Would that include wages, Mr. Mueller?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, that would include.
And it would include equipment costs and overhead
all,
and rent.
All operating costs.
Thank you. And then on the FTEs, I think we had a request, but if we didn't, I would ask that you give us, by division, the FTEs, current, projected, ups and downs. Is that what you're looking for, Representative
yes.
Green?
Yep.
Representative Green.
The question I have is you're going to give me a breakdown on what you think you might need. You're asking for money, so you already know what the cost is going to be. So I'm a little confused as you know, you're kind of alluding to the fact that you don't know what the increases are that you're going to need, but you're asking for the money. Am I hearing you wrong, or
Mr. Mueller, maybe you can tell us what's your assumption into the future for CPI price index, or how do you arrive at the future needs as you try and project what your costs are going to be over the next couple of years?
Mr. Chair and members, my recollection is that the CPI came out to be a fraction greater than 2%, and so the, you know, the understanding is that's applied to all of the costs that it takes that we spend in order to deliver the air program. So that is everything from staffing to, you know, all of the costs that put employees in the field to do their work. So the increase that we're requesting would be applied proportionally throughout the program.
Commissioner Kodalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, in terms of FTEs for the air appropriation, there is no FTE increase. And on the budget sheet, you'll note for the clean water fund piece, it shows that there's an increase of 94.5 FTEs. That is just a function of how the budgeting is done, because the way the budget system works, the appropriation for the last 2 years assumes then all those folks are let go and they're rehired again if that appropriation comes back. However, the appropriation amount was not going to change the actual amount of FTEs. And as we move forward on each budget item, we'll continue to talk about the FTEs. In the case of the one we just talked about, the Superfund and petroleum sites work, that is maintaining 8 currently existing staff that have been funded in the past with one-time money, and so that we're asking for that money to be appropriated again. As a result, in the accounting book and the change item, that comes up is an FTEs, but it's keeping on and maintaining the 8 FTEs in those areas already.
And Commissioner, and just as you addressed Representative Green's concerns about that we're not on autopilot, that we're not just automatically putting in the bumps, you know, it's another year, we get more money, boom. Are you evaluating, is the program fit today, is it needed, should it be discontinued, and are there new special needs, and that's why you're asking for more money? I think our natural concern is we want to be sure that we're just not on autopilot, just growing, just because it's another year, we need more money. Last question, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kodalka, Commissioner Kodalka, and Director, excuse me.
I thought when you were talking about on page 16 on the change item, you're talking about tanks and the programs and the remediation and so forth, and the 2% or the 2 cent click on click off tax. It seems like the feds are obviously requiring a certain amount of work to be done. So the tax, the 2 cent tax, is that now going to be used for doing inspections too, and is that a change from past practice?
Commissioner Kodalka.
Mr. Chair and Representative, sorry about the confusion there. For the portion that's not the cleanup cost, the two inspectors, that would be something new for the petrol fund that has not been covered historically under it.
Thank you. Representative Fabian, follow-up.
So does that mean then that the 2 cent tax is going to be clicked on more than it has been historically in the past?
Commissioner,
and do you have any estimates on that?
Mr. Kodalka, if you could get back to us, because I know a number of the gas stations are less, but what is this inspection? What is the anticipation? If you could get back to us with the facts about here, how often it's been on. It wouldn't be bad to see the historical perspective of how often it's been on and off, and I know the petroleum people are in the audience listening too, so it'd be good to know that. And then what do you have an anticipation in the future? Commissioner Kodalka, are you available to come back Tuesday morning? Good. We'll see you Tuesday morning. Members, we're adjourned. Have a good weekend.